Come up on a tight wire.
I'm sitting here in Studio B next to my good friend Daniel Chacon.
And I'm sitting across from my good friend Benjamin Alira Sainz.
And welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire.
Today we have a special guest. She is not only a fantastic poet and lyrical essayist, but she's also a visiting writer in the online MFA program here at UTEP. She teaches a class in poetic forms. On Poetic License, we have a former student of ours. I'm sure you've had him in many classes.
As an undergrad.
Yeah. He got his degree in creative writing. His name's Paul Pedrosa, and he's going to do a Poetic License.
And speaking of poetry, I'm teaching an undergrad poetry class this semester, and it's wonderful. And because we're doing the elegy, just an elegy is poetic form, and so we read a lot of elegies already, and they're going to start, and they're going to write their own, they're going to bring them in, and we're going to discuss them. But I also asked them as an addendum to that to think about what they might like to write on their gravestones.
Uh-huh.
And I'm really curious as to how they're going to respond.
Wow, that is an interesting thing. What would you want on your gravestone?
Something really simple. I lived.
Oh, that's almost like Neruda's memoir. Confieso que he vivido. I confess that I have lived.
But you know what's interesting? Because, because people could get funny, too. Like, you could just have an exercise with yourself.
Right.
I put it on Facebook, and some people said interesting things. One of them said they'd like on their gravestone, I forgot to tell you something. Which I think is hilarious.
Absolutely. Yeah, that is funny. You know, and I think that idea of, when you die to just say I have lived is, I think that's very important, because I think that a lot of times we spend our lives not living but thinking we're going to live once we get this or once we get that. But I think writers are an advantage, because we tend to really live life and then we write about it. I don't think you could be a good writer without being able to live in the moment.
What would you like to have on your gravestone, Daniel?
I would probably like to have, a couple of years ago, I went to Switzerland to go visit the grave of Borges, because, mm-hmm. He's buried over there. And I finally found the grave, and it's written on it, and ne fortinan na. But I guess it's Old Norse, and it means be not afraid. Maybe I would do something like that. I would do be very afraid. I don't know. I hadn't really thought about it much.
It's good to think about it. I think one of the things that I'm very attracted to, because I know the Bible, and I think it's really beautiful. Do not look among the dead for one who is living.
That makes sense.
But you could go for funny and say, well, I could have wound up in Deming.
But I don't know. I think that when I die, I just want to not have those regrets that a lot of people have. And I think one of the number one regrets, according to these articles that come out occasionally, like on the Huffington Post, top 10 things old people say that they wish they would have done different. One of them is to nurture their friendships. They wish they had spent more time with their friends and less time worrying about work and things like that.
Right.
So I just hope that when I die, I don't care if a bunch of people come to my funeral, but when I die, I want to leave a lot of friends behind.
Right. I think that's important. It's a really interesting thing about life. It's so unpredictable. And yet, it does have its predictabilities. Mm-hmm. We are all born out of a woman's womb, all of us. And
we all die. Right.
So what happens in between, there's a story. But if our life is a book, then the ending is inevitable.
Absolutely. There's this quote by Rilke that I love. He says, God grant us the right to choose our own deaths. And I've always loved that, because to me it's almost like choosing the final image of your life. How do you want the final image to be? If you could imagine your death, how would you imagine it? And I always remember that, because I think that final image in our lives works the same way as a final image in a novel. I know when you write a novel, Ben, you know the very last image. The journey getting there is what's exciting about the novel. And so I sometimes imagine the very last image in my life, and I'm not quite sure what it all means, but I know it's a beautiful image, and I live my life, and that's where the journey, that's really where everything happens. But you want to hear my final image?
What?
I'm going to be dying in a very old man. I'm going to be 120 years old, because God gives us 120 years old. You know that. You know the Bible, Ben. God gives us 120 years to live. And I'm going to be surrounded by a bunch of people who love me. And there's going to be a window because this is my home. And I'm going to look out that window. And out that window is going to be a body of water, maybe a lake or maybe an ocean. And I'm going to have a dog. And it's going to be just nice and peaceful. I'm going to close my eyes.
I don't know. I mean, I really don't, interestingly enough, have a last image because life is so unpredictable. Mm-hmm. I'd like to think that in the end we realize that really it's over. And I'd like to let go gracefully because the life that was mine is no longer mine. Mm. You know, in the end, yeah. It was a borrowed gift and to graciously let go. I don't know. I mean, life is such a beautiful thing. You know, life is more hell than I've ever wanted, and it's more heaven than I deserve. Mm. So I really love life no matter what.
Right.
And it's such a gift, and which is why poetry is such a part of it. And getting back to the elegy, I think I started with the elegy because students, you don't have to explain the necessity of the genre. That particular form of poetry will never go out of style,
right?
Because we're always dying, and we will constantly reinvent it. Wherever it was invented back in the day, it comes from the word eulogy, so to praise a life, mm-hmm. an elegy. You know, the elegy was reinvigorated, for instance, in the Age of AIDS, when so many people were dying. In fact, there's a whole anthology of poetry in the Age of AIDS, you know, because of that, the whole, you know, devastation that happened around that disease back in the 80s and early 90s. So, you know, there's a poetic form that students truly understand the relationship between the poem, poetry, the art form, and life. And you don't have to explain that connection. And maybe that's why I started it there, so that they can start seeing those connections.
Right. And it really connects on an emotional, even spiritual level, that whole idea of, well, it's going to end this way, and what do I want to be said about me?
Exactly. Well, much as I'd like to continue this conversation, Daniel,
it is done.
It's time to get on with the show. Stay tuned for Words on a Wire.
Liz Scheid received her MFA in poetry from California State University, Fresno. Her first book, The Shape of Blue, won the Lit Pub's first annual prose contest and just came out this year. And we're going to talk about that with her. Her essays and poems have appeared in the Mississippi Review, Third Coast, The Journal, Sou'wester Terrain, The Collegist, Diagram, Post Road, and other fantastic literary magazines. And also, she is a visiting writer teaching with us in the online MFA here at UTEP. Liz Scheid, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Hello.
And congratulations on your lovely book, The Shape of Blue. Tell us a little bit about the origins of this book. I mean, first of all, let me put it in context. I know you as a poet. You have an MFA. Your thesis, I believe, was in poetry, wasn't it? And,
yes.
You know, you have incredible publications in poetry, yet your first book is this, which is very, I won't say poetic because I don't think poetic is a very good word in describing language. It almost, you know, sounds like Philip Levine would say to bad writing, it's poetic. But I will say it's beautiful. It's lyrical. And so how did this one come about? Why this book?
Thank you so much for those kind words, Daniel. I studied poetry while I was in the MFA program, and I still very much love poetry, and it definitely informs my writing in whatever form that I'm doing. And I started studying nonfiction towards my last year in the program when I took a class with Stephen Church, a form and theory class of nonfiction. And he introduced us to, you know, lyrical essays and poets who were writing in prose. And I just really was drawn to that form and the poetry inside the prose and the blurring of the boundaries and the genres. And I just started writing that last year in the program and working on nonfiction as well as working on a poetry collection at the same time. but I just felt more connected with that form, and so I just went with it. And for the next couple of years, I started writing essays.
And what is the difference in the writing process for you when you're writing a poem or when you're writing an essay?
In the process, well, with a poem, I like to use the metaphor of just taking a magnifying glass to like a moment or an image and just kind of obsessing, staying inside that moment or inside that image for a period of time. And with an essay, I just kind of let my mind wander more, if that makes any sense. And so sometimes, whatever the subject matter is, I need more space to do that, and so the essay form makes more sense then. But whether it's a poem or if it's an essay, I always begin them usually in the same way, and it usually always starts with a line. I'll be thinking about something, some experience or something that happens throughout the day, and I'll go over it, throughout the day in my head until I get to a line that I can use, and then I begin the writing process from there.
One of the really interesting things about your book is that you have these notes at the end of the book, and you have a note, and you have a note for every essay that you wrote. And they're not your typical notes like a scholarly thing. You kind of make a commentary, something important about the essay, where it came from, et cetera. And they become like mini essays themselves.
The process of doing the notes was really interesting for me. It was my editor's idea. She asked me to do it. One, because a lot of the pieces, I did a lot of research, and some of them I kind of loosely cited, where I got the sources, because as I did the writing process, I started reading and researching, and sometimes even forgetting where the information came from, because I was just kind of absorbing it.
Right.
And so I wanted to integrate it so it didn't read like an academic essay. If that makes any sense.
Yes, it makes perfect sense to me. Because I do the same. Actually, I do the same thing, Liz, when I write an essay.
But she was saying, oh, no, we got to attribute where, all the sources came from. And so she asked me to do some kind of notes at the end. So even when I was doing the notes, I thought, well, I really just don't want this to be academic, because that was, so different from how the process actually was when I was doing the writing of the essay. So I focused more on the process of the writing and the process of the research when I did the notes.
Let me ask you about your influences on this particular book. I know you had a blurb from Carmen Jimenez-Smith, who wrote a fantastic, beautiful, lyrical book of essays. Do you find yourself identifying with her approach? I mean, who influences you? What kind of contemporary writers are influencing you in terms of how you approach a lyrical essay?
Definitely Carmen Jimenez-Smith. I loved that book. That definitely inspired a lot of the form of The Shape of Blue. And Leah Papura's On Looking definitely inspired it. She was, she wrote very lyrical essays, which felt more like prose poems, if anything at all. Bernard Cooper's Maps to Anywhere. There's a lot of writers out there right now, a lot of nonfiction writers who I think are more poets than anything else.
Right. It seems to be an emerging genre, the lyrical
yeah.
essay. And do you suppose you're going to be doing other books like this, or is your next book going to be a collection of poems?
The next book I'm working on is a collection of poems, but I will, after I do the collection of poems, I probably will return to that form.
When you started to write this book, did you know there was going to be so much pain in it? And how did you learn from that pain?
Yeah. For me, when I'm writing, I'm not really experiencing the emotions. I'm kind of distancing myself, and I'm trying to write about it in a way that I'm not really experiencing the emotions, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm.
So it's more of like an intellectual process for me. And when I go back and read the pieces, I think, oh, wow, that was really sad, and then I kind of experience the emotions.
You know what's interesting, how you release those emotions in 10 years after. You don't say outright at first who was that died, and then you kind of discover that when you say, stop fidgeting, Liz, sit still. And it's the voice of a mother. I found that very interesting. And in your notes, you talk about how when you were writing this, you really got into it so much that you really went, I mean, you really took a real emotional risk, so much so that you say that you were really like a mess, like you experienced her death all over again.
Right. That particular piece that you're talking about, 10 years after, that is one of my favorite pieces in the book. For me, that one was the most emotionally raw because I wrote it right after I visited the cemetery. And that one was the least revised out of any of the other pieces. So it was really, I just wrote it immediately after I went there. And I just wanted to recount the entire experience for it to be as real and raw as possible.
I think that's very courageous, Liz. I really do.
Thank you. And so I never really went back and revised that one. I submitted it to a journal, and that was just one of the luckier pieces that got accepted right away. But the other ones definitely were revised many more times than that one.
We're talking to Liz Scheid here on Words on a Wire, author of The Shape of Blue, Notes on Loss, Language, Motherhood, and Fear. Liz, are your poems talking about the same themes, the book of poems you're working on now?
Yes, they are. And I'm trying to, that's what I'm currently trying to figure out right now, because it is the same subject matter, mothering and loss, mostly. It always creeps its way into whatever it is that I'm writing about. I'll try to write about something else, and somehow those subjects seem to creep their way in, whether they're in the backdrop or they're overshadowing everything else. They always seem to make their way into whatever I'm writing about. But I want, you know, this book to be different, and I want it to be its own. So I'm trying to figure out what else is in there that defines this book and makes it its own voice.
One of the things that always fascinates me when we talk to poets, and we talk to a lot of them, is how they order their book of poems. And I love the image of, you know, them printing out the poems and putting them on the floor and looking at them in that way. And in fact, I just finished my first ever book of poems, and when I had the opportunity to do that, I was like really excited. But
congratulations.
Thank you. It's a first effort, but The Shape of Blue is not necessarily ordered chronologically. How did you decide the order of it?
Yeah, I wanted it to kind of mirror the thinking process of the speaker, and also to mirror the way that grief works. So I wanted it to kind of be read in a way that it seemed like you were going through flashbacks. So, you know, these images and these memories and these painful memories especially kind of interrupt us, you know. Yeah. They interrupt our lives, and they're unexpected and how they surprise us. And so I wanted it to reflect that.
Right. It's like memory itself. I mean, a memory can
right.
pop up, and it can pop up, and they might be connected emotionally, or they might be connected imagistically, or in this case, lyrically, but not necessarily on a time continuum, so to speak.
Exactly. Exactly.
And did you, when you were writing the book, did the order of the essays come out this way, or did you, you know, once you had the book, did you just start arranging them at that point?
Yeah, I started arranging them. My editor kind of wanted them to move more chronologically because she thought it would be easier for the reader that way. But, you know, I kind of convinced her and made my case that I wanted it to be more like a collage and to mirror memory and to mirror grief. And she said, okay, you know, I understand that. And so she said, well, then how about we work on just making it more explicit? So I had to go back into the pieces and find ways to repeat images or words so that they would lead into the next essay.
Sounds like you had a great editor that was really hands-on and working with you on the shape of this book.
Oh, yeah. She was phenomenal. Just wonderful. We went through like 10 different versions over the summer where every day, I mean, we were working together very closely, sometimes through FaceTime. We have a very close relationship. Right. I just, you know, I owe her so much, and she's just wonderful.
Did you find yourself thinking, wait a minute, that's not a good suggestion? Or were her suggestions just right on?
At first, you know, I was really just exhausted with the process. After like the fourth time the book came back and she had more suggestions for me. I was like, no, it's done. And, you know, so some of the things I was just like, oh, gosh, really? We got to revisit this essay again? That essay's been done for so long. And then, you know, I'd kind of step away from it for a little while and go back and go, you know, kind of have a fight with myself and just be like, she's right, you know? She's right. But it was very exhausting.
Yeah, at least you didn't get all diva. A lot of writers get all diva, you know, like that. What are you talking about? You know, this is just, I want it that way because it came out that way. I've had really good experiences with editors myself, and what I tend to do is my default setting for working with editors is they know a lot more than I do.
Exactly. You know, and I know she has my book. She has it in her best interest.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, so I just tried to keep that in mind the entire time.
Is there a book tour? Are you going around doing readings? How are you promoting this book? Because, you know, one of the things that we learn when we get our first book out, unless you publish, like, you know, Ben is always talking about how he comes from a different generation of writers. It was a different writing world back then, and they would send them on book tours, and they would put all this money into promotion. But it doesn't work that way anymore. There are so many books being published every year, over 100,000 every year, that when we do get a book published, that's when the work begins. You have to promote it yourself.
I know. It's been a tough process for me, that part of it, because I really don't like to promote myself. I just feel uncomfortable in doing that. So it has been hard for me to do that. For the most part, the readings that I have gotten, people have asked me to do at Fresno State and at Fresno City, and I'm doing another one here in L.A., with Rattle.
Nice.
And then in Seattle, I'm going to be signing there.
The AWP conference.
Yes.
Okay, excellent. We'll definitely look out for you. And Liz, thank you so much for appearing on Words on a Wire. We have this segment we call Poem of the Week. And you were a poet. I know. In fact, I knew you more as a poet than I did as an essayist. And you have some pretty impressive publications when it comes to your poems. Can you read a poem for us and for our Poem of the Week segment?
Sure. Yes, the poem I'm going to read is titled Magic, and that was the poem that was included in Rattle's December of 2013 issue, and it's titled Magic. I worry about my 4-year-old daughter being so morbid. Just the other day, her preschool teacher said she'd been carrying on about her imaginary dead sister again to a group of kids waiting in line for the swings. I picture her telling them about this made-up sister while kids are swinging beside her, saying things like, it was the killer ants that did it. She got a bad rash. It's so sad. Then the conversation ends and the kids go on chasing one another up and down the jungle gym. Today, it begins with a half-eaten blackbird on our porch. I tell her it's a gift from the cat, but she wants to know if she runs with it super fast on a windy day and throws it way, way up, if it'll come back down, flapping its black wings again. Yes, it seems so simple, and just like that, everything makes sense. The 13-year-old Croatian girl I saw earlier on the news, who woke from a coma, fluent in German, words spilling from her mouth so naturally, as though they always were on the tip of her tongue. Imagine it's like that for dead people, too. They step outside a kitchen door into a flock of birds fluttering about, and when they open their mouths to speak, it's all instruments, trombones and saxophones and flutes whistling from windpipes, their tonsils flapping like cymbals. Nothing about the dead imaginary sister seems strange to the other preschools or to her teacher. Kids just tell stories, she said. I tell my daughter the blackbird is fine. How do you know? I don't, I say, and she just moves on, spinning in circles, twirling underneath a cotton white sky.
That was lovely. Thank you for sharing that with our listening audience, Liz. It's been a real pleasure having you on our show. And listen, best of luck to you on your book of essays, The Shape of Blue. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
My name is Paul Pedrosa. I was born and raised in El Paso, Texas, and currently I teach in the English department at New Mexico State University. And for my poetic license, I'd like to read an excerpt from a story called The Rain Parade, which was first published by Palabra Magazine, and will also appear in the upcoming New Border Voices anthology from Texas A&M University Press. The rain parade begins at dusk this year. The crowd gathers, breath condensing, humid against the inner fabric of ponchos and coats. The bright colors mellow with the coming night. Those without umbrellas hug the damp buildings for shelter, but they're wet anyway. They've come out to see the same floats they always see, year after year, although this is the first rain parade to be held at night. Sawhorses, raw in the blowing rain, close many of the streets. A boy straddles one down by the restaurants on Mesa Street, and no one's near him keeping watch. Although it's raining, the sunset is clear to all who can see among the buildings downtown. Dying sunlight paints the clean, blinded windows scarlet. The sounds of traffic no longer echo down the empty avenues from the freeway nearby. Cars double parked along the outlying streets stand empty. A few doors have been left unlocked, some left wide open. There's a thick silence. Coffee steam and strained coughing. A young girl whines softly about a lost bracelet, and then a siren wails down the block, startling those who chose the corner of Campbell and Main because they want to brag about seeing everything first and best. The siren sounds for a minute like approaching destruction, then settles into a moan, and when it does, the first band leader, Oscar Gutierrez, steps down from the curb and marches down the soaked asphalt toward his band waiting in the middle of Main. As he raises his baton, he's afraid of the snaggled portions of the street that will inevitably trip him, that will dig into his tailbone like every year he's participated before. The trumpets resound with flair. The Benito Juarez High School Marching Band, Oscar's Band, launches into the Star-Spangled Banner, an honor bestowed upon them by lottery. They march down the street alone while they perform. When the strain of woodwinds and brass and the boom of percussion fade into the sound of broken raindrops, the street is empty. The rain parade begins with a cavalcade of horses. The well-groomed studs, courtesy of the equestrian club, turn their rain-soaked heads in the cold air to sniff the scent of the mares that follow. The mares belong to Edgar Perez, a rancher who owns 50 acres just outside of town. He brings them out year after year because he believes the rain of the rain parade to be blessed and says his stock could use a little divine intervention. He wishes he could stop the parade and mate the mares with the studs, but he cannot find the courage to do it. The horses stop down towards San Jacinto Plaza, and as they do, many snort and play to the crowd, especially the studs. The bands tramp through the already forming puddles, and once they reach San Jacinto Plaza, they huddle beneath the palms and junipers and wait for their buses to come and take them home. Taking Oscar Gutierrez's band's lead, the kids, afraid the thin alloy will attract lightning, leave their instruments on grass and concrete and walk away. It is a graveyard of wet brass and wood. The instruments will never be the same. For Words on a Wire, I'm Paul Pedrosa.
We'd like to thank our guest, Liz Scheid, for joining us on this edition of Words on a Wire. I highly recommend her book. It's quite beautiful, very lovely book.
And we'd like to thank Paul Pedrosa for his wise words today on Poetic License.
Join us next week for another edition of Words on a Wire. I'm Daniel Chacon.
I'm Benjamin Alida Science.
And don't forget,
the next book you read
may save your life.
I'm up on a tight wire. One side's ice and one is fire.